From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! Is tobacco money choking the political process? We'll look at how campaign contributions from cigarette companies are snuffing out congressional action. You've heard of Freedom Summer? Well, this summer is Union Summer. The AFL-CIO is launching a massive campaign to revitalize the labor movement with fresh young organizers. And we'll hear from one of the newest and most progressive members of Congress.
We are living in an era where politicians have the courage of Pontius Pilate. Let the crowd decide. Follow the polls. Which way is the wind blowing? Crucify him. People whose real wages have declined over the past 20 years, both their fears and not their hopes. And the pollsters know this. Politicians without courage wear signs on their backs that read, "For sale."
His name is Jesse Jackson, Jr. That and more coming up on Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now!, Pacifica Radio's daily national grassroots election show. I'm Amy Goodman. The recruitment posters for the AFL-CIO's Organizing Institute say, "Organizer, the best job in America." With under 15% of the U.S. workforce currently unionized, some say it's one of the hardest jobs in America. The new leadership of the AFL-CIO has said that it's committed to changing these numbers in large part by training new organizers and putting them out on the streets. The AFL-CIO's current recruiting campaign for organizers is focused on young people. The vehicle for attracting these young people to the labor movement is Union Summer, modeled on the civil rights movement's Freedom Summer of 30 years ago. With us today is Andy Levin, director of Union Summer, and Maria Naranjo, a young woman who is lead organizer in the D.C. Justice for Janitors campaign. Well, let's start with Andy Levin. What is Union Summer? We're having a little trouble hearing you, Andy. A little more trouble there. And we're going to go to a musical break and see if we can improve this connection. Again, I want to let people know what's coming up today. We're going to be talking with Jesse Jackson, Jr., actually not talking with him directly, but hearing a speech he gave recently to the Communication Workers of America. And then we're going to be talking about tobacco money in Congress. The U.S. PIRG, the Public Interest Research Group, and Common Cause have done a study. They've done a study that looks at tobacco money in congressional campaigns. And then we're going to be taking a look at one of the few groups called the Calvert Group, that is a mutual fund that does not invest in tobacco companies. Now, before we go to a musical break, we're going to see if we can hear Andy Levitt. Are you there? Yeah, we are having a little trouble. So we're going to go to a musical break, and then we'll be back. Stay with us, folks. You're listening to Democracy Now! Listening to Democracy Now!, I'm Amy Goodman. Sorry for that temporary musical interruption, but we are back with our guests. And in this first segment, we're talking about Union Summer. And as I said earlier, we're joined by Andy Levin, director of Union Summer, and Maria Naranjo, a young woman who's lead organizer with the D.C. Justice for Janitors campaign. We're going to begin with Andy Levin. Why don't you tell us what Union Summer is?
Hi, Amy. Well, Union Summer is the AFL-CIO's effort to get 1,000 young people out into the streets this summer working on union organizing campaigns and political projects that benefit working people.
And why don't you tell us exactly what the dimension of this, where you're doing it?
Well, we're going to have 10 to 20 sites around the country from coast to coast. We'll begin announcing the sites within a week or two. There will certainly be some in the South where the labor movement has not focused enough energy in the past, but also we'll have sites on the West Coast, on the East Coast, and everywhere in between. And we're going to have three-week waves of Union Summer all summer long, from June to Labor Day, in different places at different times.
And what will the labor movement get out of this summer?
Well, you know, that's a great question, because part of what Union Summer is about is certainly getting a lot of young folks to pitch in to help working people win organizing campaigns and to help us win living wage referendums and to fight off attacks on affirmative action in different states around the country. But really what we're hoping to do is give as much as to get. We really want to give an incredible three-week experience to a lot of young activists so that they begin to feel like the labor movement is at the heart of the fight for social change again in this country.
Whose brainchild was this, Andy?
Well, you know, that's a good question. It was Union Summer was a plank in the platform of the Sweeney, Trumka, Chavez, Thompson team that won the leadership of the AFL-CIO at the famous contested convention in October. It turns out that several senior aides to the new leadership actually participated in Freedom Summer in Mississippi, and I think that's why it got into the platform.
Why don't you put Maria Naranjo on the phone? Maria Naranjo is with the D.C. Justice for Janitors campaign, which is part of the SEIU. That's the Service Employees International Union. Tell us how you all fit in.
Well, basically, the Service Employees International Union, Justice for Janitors campaign is one of the most militant, probably grassroots campaign here in the United States. And we're also in the process of trying to become a site for Union Summer so that young activists, young union rank and file members, all the participants of Union Summer can at least spend a week or two with us in the streets here in Washington, D.C., as we fight for better wages and benefits for all janitors here in Washington, D.C.
Why don't you tell us what this Justice for Janitors campaign is? Specifically, who are the janitors in D.C.?
Justice for Janitors is a national organizing drive, mainly found in the larger cities like Los Angeles, Denver, Colorado, Hartford, and here in Washington, D.C. And what we try to do is organize non-union janitorial workers who are probably the lowest paid, most exploited workers that I've seen. They are immigrant workers. A lot of them are, at least here in Washington, D.C., are from Central America, from El Salvador. Many of them have left the war in El Salvador and Guatemala to come here to the United States. And when they get here, you know, they work long hours with minimum wage. So that's basically, we're targeting this workforce, and we're trying to organize them and try to get them to have justice in the workplace.
You know, it's interesting, Maria. In 1988, I was at the Democratic Convention in Atlanta, Georgia. Mm-hmm. And that's when I first came in contact with the Justice for Janitors campaign. They were protesting that Good Morning America was coming out of a anti-union hotel.
Uh-huh.
And as a result, Good Morning America was forced not to broadcast from this hotel. That's how successful the campaign was.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, it's those kinds of tactics, it's sort of those kinds, we need to sort of be in-your-face tactics that Justice for Janitors has always used, and we continue to use here in Washington, D.C., and I think it's really the only way that we as workers can actually get anything in this country. We're not going to just get it sitting around and at the table sort of talking about it, right? We're going to sort of get it when we're out there in the streets, you know, making a lot of noise and sort of being up front with our issues.
Maria, as a young person, how did you get involved with the Justice for Janitors campaign?
I was very much involved in my college campus with a lot of Latino issues, the minority students movement at my college, which is a predominantly white, you know, Ivy League school where I went, and sort of was always interested in fighting for the rights of people of color. And from then, as soon as I'd heard about Justice for Janitors or someone from the Organizing Institute had contacted me, I knew that I sort of wanted to do all my work and Justice for Janitors specifically, or mostly working with the Latino community, which Justice for Janitors does.
And you're listening to Maria Naranjo, who is with the Justice for Janitors campaign in Washington, D.C., and also Andy Levin, who is with Union Summer. I wanted to ask Andy Levin, what do you say to, for example, the Republicans in particular are launching a real attack on the union, saying that the AFL-CIO is increasing its dues to put money into Democratic campaigns, that that in fact the Democrats are being controlled by special interests when they refer to the AFL-CIO?
Well, it's kind of ironic because really what the new leadership of the AFL-CIO is doing in ramping up spending during this election season is building labor's own capacity to organize and get its message out to its own members, information about voting records of people, rather than being a captive interest to any party. So the labor movement is saying that we're going to have a team of 100 activists in every congressional district to organize for candidates who support working people's issues. And the fact that Republicans, almost to a person, oppose the interests of working people is their problem.
Andy, how did you get involved with Union Summer, and how did you get involved with the AFL-CIO?
Well, I ran the field operation of the New Voice campaign, the campaign of President Sweeney to win the election at the convention last fall. And I started out my career as a union organizer with the Service Employees Union, President Sweeney's union, in 1983, organizing nursing home workers primarily in Michigan and Massachusetts. So when I came out of college, I felt like the only way that serious change was going to happen in this country was if working people had more power over their own lives, and unions are the way to make that happen.
What is your goal in terms of organizing? I mean, right now we're talking about under 15% of the U.S. workforce currently unionized.
Right, and under 11% of the private sector. There's clearly a crisis in this country of working people not being organized, and you can see the results in terms of the growing gap between the rich and poor because working people don't have any power to get their fair share. So we are hoping to massively increase the number of people who join unions every year. I don't know. I can't give you numerical goals that we have exactly, but I can tell you the task in front of us. We have to organize 300,000 new members a year just to keep union density where it is now, that 15% of all workers, 10.5% of the private sector, and to begin to regain the kind of political clout and clout against the boss that workers had 20, 30 years ago. We've got to start organizing 1 million people a year. So Union Summer is really an expression of that need because we're saying we're going to go out and find young people in general and turn them on to the idea that this is what they can do to really learn how to organize and to fight for social justice in this country. And we've got to make the labor movement the heart of those bigger struggles again if we're going to start organizing on a massive scale.
Let me ask Maria Naranjo this question of the Justice for Janitors campaign in D.C. Justice Janitors campaign also is a national campaign. Mm-hmm. Maria, the unions over the years, when it comes to people of color, many people of color have felt that they had two obstacles to face. One was being hired at all,
right.
And one also was being accepted by unions, often all white unions. What do you feel about that, and what do you tell young people whose parents and grandparents told them about those struggles?
I mean, I think that myself as a person of color, as a Latino woman, and other folks, I always tell myself we have to sort of, there's two things we can do. We can sort of sit back and say, yes, you know, the labor movement is run by a bunch of old white men, right? We can sit back and say, but I'm tired of making $5.25 an hour. Or we can say, I'm going to get involved, I'm going to get in, I'm going to try to make a change. And I wouldn't, you know, lie to young people or to people of color out there and say it's easy, because it's not. And we all know the reality out there, whether it's in unions or in any progressive organization or in corporations. We as people of color need to get more involved. At least with Justice for Janitors, our focus has been immigrant workers because we are becoming the workforce. We are the workforce now in this country, at least in the service sector, in the farming sector, and other sectors, in factories. And we really need to become involved in our unions. And the reality is that unions are the only really true voice of power that we have. And I really believe that. And I would encourage other people of color to get involved in the struggle. Because it will be a struggle not only for your corporation, but also maybe within your union. But it's worth the struggle, because I think in the end, you'll see that, you know, the union can actually represent you and your race or your ethnic background.
Well, we're going to wrap up now. I just want to ask you, if people are interested in Union Summer, if they're interested in being a part of it, how can they get in touch with you?
They can call us at 800-952-2550. Or fax us at 202-408-0303. But anybody who wants information or to apply for Union Summer can just call that 800 number, 952-2550.
And that's 1-800-952-2550. I want to thank you both very much for joining us. We've been joined by Andy Levin, who is director of Union Summer, and Maria Naranjo, who is lead organizer in the D.C. Justice for Janitors campaign. You're listening to Democracy Now! Up next, Jesse Jackson, Jr., and we'll also be talking about tobacco money in politics, more precisely, in congressional campaigns. I'm Amy Goodman. You're listening to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Coming up in a little while, we'll be talking about tobacco money. Is it choking the political process? And we'll be talking about some mutual funds that do not invest in tobacco companies. But right now, Jesse Jackson, Jr. He's the newest member of Congress, one of the youngest and one of the most progressive members of Congress. Here's an excerpt from the first major address he's given since he came to Washington. He gave it to the Communication Workers of America last week. And we are having technical difficulties here. We are trying to hear right now Jesse Jackson's speech in Washington last week. Well, before we go to Jesse Jackson's speech, here we go. Here we go, Jesse Jackson's speech.
That I've had to the 104th Congress is a movie by Eddie Murphy called The Distinguished Gentleman. There was a time when I used to think that that movie was a joke. In reality, it's a parody on our political system, and no truer words or drama could have captured the reality of how this country and this Congress operate. I might go so far as to say that there's a point in time in that movie when they talk about the two pillars of our system coming together. Those two pillars, one being financial, and the other being political. And when the two come together and they merge, something unique happens in our country. It's called legislation. And quite frankly, ladies and gentlemen, it's unfortunate. Without meaningful finance and campaign reform, the rights of working people, the ears of politicians, will indeed not be on the side of working people. Now, maybe I'm saying something that I probably should not say, and seeing as though I've only been in Congress for 2 months and don't know enough about Washington to be confused or swayed by its processes, maybe we can have an honest conversation for just a few minutes about what's taking place in our country and the role that working people must play. It is no exaggeration to say that we are in one of the most critical periods in our nation's history. The forces of reaction, of racism, of sexism, and in some instances even fascism, are manifesting themselves in our society. They're increasingly making their way into social policy. It is seen in so-called welfare reform, in Medicare and Medicaid, in proposals which in reality are attempts to dismantle the federal social safety net, the floor beneath which no American should ever fall. A floor that has taken us 60 years of struggle to put in place, and anti-affirmative action proposals that are really political ploys to make political points in 1996 elections. As the systematic causes of our economic and social woes go untreated, a host of local and national leaders are peddling the snake oil of scapegoating. This is where we come in, workers. We don't have to buy it. Together we can find the real remedies to cure our common problems. The Chinese symbols that comprise the word crisis are a combination of the symbols of danger and opportunity. That's what we are confronted with, danger and opportunity. The Cold War threat of core annihilation has faded. But many nations are racked by internal conflict. Our nation is growing increasingly divided. The ruinous social and economic trends that we've been warned about have intensified. Wealth is trickling down. It is not trickling down. I'm going to take my time, y'all. It's flooding upward. Real wages for average workers have plummeted despite rising productivity. Many corporate executives make more in a week than their workers make in a year. Unemployment is high whether the economy is in recession or in recovery. The war on poverty has given way to the escalating war on the poor. Our urban areas are in decline. Economic inequality is now so extreme that the richest 1% of American families have nearly as much wealth as the entire bottom 95%. More than a fifth of all children and half of all African American children are living in poverty in this, the world's richest nation. That's according to the government, which undercounts both poverty and unemployment. The angry, shrinking middle class is misled into thinking that those lower on the economic ladder are pulling them down, when in reality, those on top are rising at the expense of those below. People who should be working together to transform the economic policies that are hurting everyone are instead turning hatefully on each other. Look at the candidates. Look at the options before us in 1996. As we watch the 1996 presidential campaign unfold, it seems that everyone is looking for the right message and the right following that will catapult them into the White House. Senator Robert Dole is trying to fit right-wing extremists, angry white males, and moderate Republicans under one tent. Pat Buchanan is looking for a platform to echo racist, sexist, xenophobic, fascist beliefs as he appeals to the worst in American fears about job security and economic insecurity. He is living his life, as Dr. Samuel DeWitt Proctor has proclaimed, in the anti. He's anti-affirmative action, anti-immigrant, anti-public education, anti-woman, anti-gay and lesbian. He's so anti-everything, we don't even know what he stands for. President Clinton in our own party is looking for the will and the courage to stand for something other than a poll. He's a great politician, but it's not the way to win the Congress back. Compare our present situation to Franklin Delano Roosevelt's message. A chicken in every pot. A message that the common man, the common person in our society understood. In 1996, so far, the only presidential candidate that has a message that is reaching every American is Ken Griffey. He wants to put a shoe on every foot. Why has no message emerged in 1996? We are living in an era where politicians have the courage of Pontius Pilate. Let the crowd decide. Follow the polls. Which way is the wind blowing? Crucify him. People whose real wages have declined over the past 20 years vote their fears and not their hopes. And the pollsters know this. And politicians without courage wear signs on their backs that read, "For sale." It's wrong. For Republicans in the 104th Congress to try to balance its budget on the backs of people who are poor and are defenseless. It is wrong, it is immoral, and we ought not stand for it. To realize community over chaos, we must revitalize democracy with plain talk about who really benefits and who loses from government policy. We need vigorous debate over how to reshape policy in the public interests, not the pseudo-debate of false campaign promises, negative political ads, and talk radio hate mongering. Rights and entitlements familiar today, among them the 8-hour workday, minimum wage, Social Security, and the right of workers to organize and bargain collectively were obtained in the face of strong opposition. Many of these achievements are being eroded. Demagoguery and scapegoating are threatening democracy and turning people away from finding many of the solutions they need from political and government processes. The current climate is replacing hope and optimism and positive political involvement with cynicism, pessimism, negativism, despair, and a view that voting is kind of silly and has no effect on their real lives. To realize community over chaos, we must replace fear with courage and pessimism with hope. Only then can we protect the old gains and forge new social, political, and economic rights for the 21st century. Those who have conducted class warfare resent it and protest it when you merely describe the state of America in 1996. To divert attention away from this massive inequality, the greatest disparity in wealth of any industrialized nation in the history of the world, they tell you that the problem is the poor. The problem is people of color. The problem is the immigrants. The problem with American society are the unions. The problem is affirmative action. They especially like to spread myths about affirmative action. Myth number one, white males are being hurt and discriminated against because of affirmative action. White males, 33% of the population, but 80% of the tenured professors, 80% of the U.S. House of Representatives, 90% of the United States Senate, 92% of the Forbes 400, 97% of school superintendents, 98% of professional athletic team owners, and 100% of all U.S. presidents and vice presidents discriminated against. Since the inception of the nation, white males were given preferential treatment, including the right to vote, the right to own land, the right to apply for loans, enter institutions of higher learning. In the late 1800s, white males were given millions of acres of mineral and soil-rich land under the Homestead Act. Such preferential treatment has carried over to 1996. White males, still the most educated, still the most highly paid, still the wealthiest, the most politically powerful, and occupy the most prestigious conditions. The issue is not to pit black and brown, white, male, and female against each other. The issue is to make the pie large enough and fair enough so that all of us can develop to the fullest of our potential. Potential, that's right. I realize I don't have much more time. But this is the first speech I've given since I've been in Washington. So bear with me for just a minute, CWA. Myth number two, affirmative action creates preferences for women and people of color. After 250 years of slavery, 100 years of apartheid, 40 years of discrimination, this unbroken record of race and sex discrimination has warranted a conservative remedy, and it's called affirmative action. Many African Americans, white women in our society, women in our society in general, would rather have 40 acres and a mule. That's the liberal program. Affirmative action is a conservative remedy that came from the Supreme Court. Not correcting for past injustices, but no more injustices going into the future. Actually, reparations are obviously a truer to America's history. That's what we did for Western Europe. It's what we did for Japan. It's what we continue to do for Israel. Those who've been locked out through negative action need affirmative action laws to protect them from both a discriminatory legacy and continuing discrimination. We need not be race neutral, but racially inclusive. We need to be color and gender blind. We need not be color and gender blind, but color and gender caring. Myth number three. I'm almost finished with these myths. Affirmative action has hurt people of color, women, and the nation. That's Clarence Thomas's point of view. He's an affirmative action beneficiary. And after having gone to college on affirmative action scholarships, after having been selected as the African American justice to replace an African American justice, suddenly he's against affirmative action. They leaped over a whole bunch of quote unquote qualified people to get to him. Affirmative action has obviously benefited the entire nation. It has benefited corporations. We have the strongest and the most diversified workforce in the world. It has benefited families, allowing two-wage earner households. It has benefited minorities, African Americans, Latinos, Hispanics, Asians, and Native Americans, women and the disabled. It has helped create a new middle class. Myth number four, affirmative action is no longer needed. We cannot fall prey to the inane notion that discrimination is an evil of the past. It's a very painful reality today. While affirmative action has diversified and improved the American workforce and its centers of higher learning, as a nation, we still have a long way to go. An operative word today is change. Change can be for the better or for the worse. There are three major policy shifts going on in Congress today, and I'm preparing to close. Y'all don't mind? No, I'm going to close on a high note in just a minute. Three major policy shifts. The first is shifting substantial amount of government benefits from low and moderate income families to high income families. We didn't talked about that already, and to corporations. Second, it's again shifting federal spending from domestic to defense programs. We gave the Pentagon $7 billion more than it even asked for. Third, shifting responsibility from various areas of government from the federal level to the state and to the local level. In other words, it's moving from a federal standard like equal protection under the law and federal guarantees and federal floors to state floors. There is a way out. What's the way out, Jesse Jr.? It's called jobs for all. Adequate income for all. Individual and family income sufficient for the full realization of human potential to be acquired from paid employment, income support, or a combination of the two. Who here doesn't believe in welfare reform? But welfare reform without a job that pays an adequate income for someone who was on welfare is actually a disincentive. It's mean, it's cruel, and it's wrong. And you can tell them, Democrats, Republicans alike, that I said it.
And that was Jesse Jackson Jr., one of the newest and most progressive members of Congress, speaking last week to the Communications Workers of America. Coming up next is Tobacco Money Choking the Political Process, after this. You are listening to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Tobacco is the only legal product that, when used as directed, kills. Tobacco use is the leading preventable cause of death, killing 434,000 Americans each year, including 50,000 non-smokers killed by secondhand smoke. Incredibly, the tobacco industry's strategy is to replace its dead customers with kids and teenagers. 3,000 start smoking regularly each day. Ominously, after years of decline, youth smoking is up. And what are political leaders doing about it? Remarkably little. Critics say that's because the cigarette industry is lining the pockets of elected officials. And today we're going to look at just how much money is going out into congressional campaigns. We're going to be speaking with a spokesperson for U.S. Public Interest Research Group. His name is Ed Mrzewinski. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you, Amy.
Why don't you tell us about this study that you just put out?
The Public Interest Research Group's new study, Smoking Them Out, documents $10 million in tobacco industry campaign contributions directly to members of Congress from 1986 to 1995. We looked at how the industry is targeting its money primarily at freshmen, primarily at Republicans, and we looked at just how much money is going to people who are trying to stop the Food and Drug Administration and the president from enacting tough restrictions on teenage smoking. One of the major findings we found is that the members of Congress who supported a letter to the Food and Drug Administration that was presented by the tobacco industry received over 69 times the contributions that members who are supporting the Food and Drug Administration itself received. So we're finding what you might think, that the industry is trying to buy members of Congress with camel cash in order to influence the Congress to roll back President Clinton and the Food and Drug Administration's tough restrictions on teenage smoking.
Why is it that we get so little information on how much money is going into these campaigns? How hard did you have to dig to find out this information?
Well, actually, Amy, on a national level, it's getting easier and easier to document straight campaign contributions. And the Federal Election Commission has got a lot of it up on the World Wide Web. You can get the older data if you get onto their database. What's really hard is to document the state-by-state contributions to state candidates and the amounts of money that the tobacco industry is, in fact, pouring into state initiatives and referendums. That's a vast sewer that people have only begun to touch the edges of.
Let's talk about, over the last 10 years, who some of the biggest recipients of tobacco PAC money are in Congress.
Well, not surprisingly, the gentleman from Richmond who chairs the Commerce Committee in the House of Representatives is the leading recipient of tobacco PAC money. That's Thomas Bliley, and he received over $127,000, according to our study. Other leading recipients include many members from tobacco states, Charlie Rose of North Carolina, L.F. Payne of the Virginia Tobacco Farming Districts. Not surprisingly, House Minority Leader Dick Gephardt, Senate Majority Leader Bob Dole, Tom DeLay, another leader. Most of the leaders are very high recipients of tobacco PAC money.
Since Bob Dole is the Republican presidential candidate, at least as far as we can see, unless anything unforeseen happens, why don't you tell us specifically about Bob Dole and his relation to tobacco?
Well, Bob Dole's Senate and his presidential campaign over the last 10 years received $63,400. He was third in the Senate. Wendell Ford of Kentucky was first. Mr. Ford is, of course, chairman of the Rules Committee and a leading Democrat. Jesse Helms right behind Ford. But Bob Dole came in fourth, and he is very, in our opinion, close to a lot of the industry's legislation. One of the big bills where environmental groups such as the PIRGs were able to defeat Senator Dole last year was the bill known as Regulatory Reform, or the so-called Risk Your Health Bill. Last summer, three times Mr. Dole was unable to get his bill considered on the Senate floor, although industry, including the tobacco industry, worked very hard. So we were pleased with that, but they continue to pour hundreds of thousands of dollars from many industries into trying to pass that bill. But we think Dole takes a lot of tobacco money, and we're sure that it influences his positions.
How about, for example, flying in U.S. tobacco jets?
That's absolutely in addition, I want to point out, to the campaign contributions that we have documented. We look at direct campaign contributions to political action committees in our study. and additional contributions to the party apparatus, additional contributions of soft money to the party committees, double over the last 10 years the amounts of money that the tobacco industry has given. And that money is harder to document, but you can presume that most of it goes toward the top of the ticket and toward vulnerable members on the under ticket.
And let's talk about where that tobacco PAC money is coming from. For example, Philip Morris, RJR Nabisco, Brown and Williamson, that's been recently embarrassed by the 60 Minutes story of one of its vice presidents coming out and saying that its CEO lied.
The great bulk of the tobacco money comes from Philip Morris and R.J. Reynolds, each at over $3 million in direct PAC contributions over the last 10 years. U.S. Tobacco, which makes spit tobacco or smokeless tobacco, as they prefer, over $1.5 million, and the Tobacco Institute and Brown and Williamson right behind. But I think that Philip Morris and RJR Nabisco are the big tobacco PAC donors. They're lobbyists, by the way, and the Tobacco Institute lobbyists claim that they make other products. My answer to that is the FDA is not trying to ban Oreos.
What about
this is the only thing they care about.
What about the Tobacco Institute? What is it exactly?
Well, the Tobacco Institute is just a front group for the tobacco industry. They're a lobbying operation, and they do a whole lot of the lobbying up on Capitol Hill, and they try to influence the media. They've got a lot of spin doctors. They've got a lot of PR flacks. Nobody believes them that I know, but they pour a lot of money through it.
You know, I should say that U.S. PIRG is not the only one to have done this study, of course, U.S. Public Interest Research Group, although it's a very important study that you did. In addition to you, you've got Common Cause that also did a study, and together you held a press conference with Campaign for Tobacco-Free Kids. Can you talk at all about the campaign and what the new initiative is to get politicians to stop taking tobacco money?
Yes, the Campaign for Tobacco-Free Kids is a project of the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation and other groups that are members of the Coalition on Smoking or Health. And these organizations, which include the Cancer Society, the Lung Association, and the Heart Association, seek to get, number one, no advertising to kids of tobacco, and number two, to get congressional candidates to pledge not to take tobacco PAC money. So the Campaign for Tobacco-Free Kids will be running advertisements and will be coordinating a whole lot of efforts around the country to ensure a tobacco-free future for America's children. As you pointed out at the beginning of the show, 90% of new users of tobacco are hooked before the age of 18. So this campaign seeks to prevent the tobacco merchants from marketing their products to kids and seeks to get congressmen to pledge not to take tobacco money. A small number, about 15% of senators and representatives, don't take it now. We're asking everyone to stop taking it.
Are you calling for anything else at U.S. Public Interest Research Group?
Well, U.S. PIRG supports efforts to get all big money out of politics, Amy. And in fact, CalPIRG's campaign against political corruption is where we're focusing our efforts. They're attempting to qualify the toughest campaign finance reform initiative in history out in California for the November ballot. And we are seeking that all contributions be limited to $100 per individual, per PAC, or per organization. We are seeking to require candidates to receive money from people in their own districts, and we're seeking to really, like I say, get all big money out of politics. If we can convince the California people, and I think the California people have some idea of just how much money is spent in Sacramento, but the tobacco industry spends more money in California than they do in Washington, then we can move this campaign state by state and hopefully pass tough campaign contribution reform nationally.
Well, I want to thank you very much, Ed Merzwinski, for joining us, spokesperson for U.S. Public Interest Research Group. His report is called Smoking Them Out, Tobacco PAC Contributions 1986 to 1995. How can people get a copy of this report?
You can get a copy of the report from U.S. PIRG at 218 D Street Southeast, Washington 20003. You can download it off our website, www.us.pirg.org. PIRG.org.
And, of course, you can always call Information in Washington if you want to call U.S. PIRG. I want to bring into this conversation Seth Goldman. He's with the Calvert Group, and he can explain what that is. But you may have seen the ads last week in the Washington Post and the New York Times. Does your mutual fund money go places you never dreamed of? In fact, you may be very critical of politicians receiving tobacco money, but you may be investing in tobacco companies yourself, either through a pension fund or your own investment in a mutual fund. Seth Goldman, can you tell us what the Calvert Group is and where mutual fund money goes?
Hi, Amy. The Calvert Group is a family of mutual funds, and we have $1.4 billion in socially responsible mutual funds. Those are mutual funds that make a point of investing with vision and values, avoiding investments like tobacco or weapons in companies that have bad environmental records or bad employment or labor records. What we found is that we've been doing this for 14 years, and we have people who already are aware of it. But there are a lot of people around the country who invest in a mutual fund and then don't think about where the money goes and really don't understand or have thought about what they own. And what we wanted to do, especially where the awareness is so high about what tobacco companies are doing, is make people realize that they do have a tool to, in a way, protest what the tobacco companies are doing and to divert their money away from tobacco companies and toward causes and companies that are more in line with their values and their priorities.
Now, although you are a representative of the Calvert Group, there are a number of mutual funds groups that don't invest in tobacco companies, like Pax World Fund, for example. What are some of the other ones?
There's also what used to be Working Assets is now called the Citizens Trust. There's the Parnassus Fund. There are about 32 funds as tracked by a group called the Social Investment Forum.
And how, if people are interested in finding out about these, one, who would they call as opposed to a specific group like Calvert Group? And second, how can they pressure their companies, for example, if they have a pension fund that is invested in a mutual fund, how could they pressure them to pull out of tobacco companies?
Well, it's a tough piece of information to get. A lot of mutual fund companies have this available through their annual reports, but it's not always clear to find. A recent survey done by Co-op America found that 9 of the 15 largest mutual funds listed tobacco companies as one of their top 10 holdings. But every investor has the right to ask their mutual fund company if they're invested in tobacco. Now, of course, at the present time, the company may not be, but it may invest tomorrow. So it's not the easiest thing to track. But people do have to we are encouraging people to start asking those questions. If they have a financial advisor, they should certainly make that known, that this is one of their concerns. And we also hope that at some point financial advisors start asking their customers, are there any investments that you feel aren't suitable for you?
Do you have any success stories of, for example, people who pressure their pension funds to pull out of mutual funds that invest in tobacco companies?
Well, we haven't seen that. We do know a lot of groups that are trying to encourage their employers to offer the what we call either a green pension fund or a socially responsible pension option. A lot of companies just don't have that. People don't have the right to choose that now. So,
do you make the same profit, by the way?
It varies, I think, like any mutual fund. We have some funds that did very well last year. But, you know, part of this is expanding the definition of what we call return. I think, you know, people who just go by the numbers are only looking at one part of the equation. And when you think about the other things that we're doing with our money, the fact that we're investing in urban and rural communities and rebuilding them, encouraging innovative startup companies. But I don't want to seem like I'm ducking the question. We did have we do have some funds that have, you know, exceeded their averages, and then some I guess it varies just like any mutual fund company.
Seth, we're going to have to wrap up, but I wanted to ask if people want to get in touch with the Social Investment Forum to find out about these different funds that are tobacco-free, how can they reach them?
I don't have the number for the Social Investment Forum.
Are they based in Washington?
They're based in New York City.
Based in New York City, and so people can look it up in the phone book. It's called the Social Investment Forum. And we want to thank Seth Goldman for joining us from the Calvert Group, which placed the ads last week in newspapers around the country. Does your mutual fund money go places you never dreamed of? Start finding out. Democracy Now! Has been produced by Julie Drizin and Pat Greenfield. It was engineered by Bernard White and Errol Maitland. Tomorrow, we'll be taking a look at Ross Perot, Bob Dole, and also looking at the Montana standoff. Join us again for another edition of Democracy Now!